Levenger.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Jeff Levenger for Devon Energy. The issue in this case is whether Mariner is contractually obligated to pay its share of the expenses associated with the abandonment and the removal of an offshore platform that was toppled into the Gulf by Hurricane Rita. The answer we submit is yes, and unambiguously yes. Now, the Court below could have and should have reached that result by focusing on the terms abandonment expenses and abandonment operations, which the parties' agreement defined expansively and without any limitation whatsoever. Instead, what the Court did was to seize on one other sentence in the letter agreement, to construe it in a grammatically incorrect fashion, to then read words into that sentence that simply aren't there to create a limitation that doesn't exist, and then to bolster that entire interpretation with expert testimony that was inadmissible and should not have been considered by the Court. Now, we think the correct interpretation will become, we think, readily apparent when the Court looks at the letter agreement which we've handed up to the Court, which I hope you have with some shading of what we think are the correct terms. Now, the proper construction of this letter agreement should start with the definitions in yellow and with the reference to actual abandonment expenses that are in the blue highlighted paragraph. And these key sentences describe what it is that Mariner has to pay, namely its share of the actual abandonment expenses at the time they're incurred, and it defines what those abandonment expenses cover, namely any abandonment operations, namely the work, including but not limited to the work of abandoning the platform, removing the platform and the wells, et cetera, defined expansively and without limitation. So when you put all this together, what it reveals is that Mariner is liable for its share of all the costs associated with any abandonment work, regardless of whether those costs and that work are affected or relate in any way to things like a collision or an explosion or a fire or, in this case, storm damage.
Well, Counsel, let me ask about that. Let me walk to it just fairly slowly, which I'll probably have to do. This is a case about extra expenses that were due to the hurricane, more expensive abandonment costs than would otherwise have been anticipated. Fair statement?
That's a fair statement, yes.
I know it may sound loaded. It wasn't meant to be.
I think that way.
If the decision by the operator had been to repair these facilities and to continue operations or restart operations, the defendant would not have been liable for those costs.
Correct, because of paragraph 7 of the accounting COPUS procedure that's attached to the JOA agreement, which says that the working interest owner is responsible for costs associated with repair or replacement due to a variety of things, including a storm.
I didn't remember what paragraph, but that was going to be my next paragraph, because the COPUS already, the form accounting, already identifies storm as costs. And regardless of that, it does seem to me what you've highlighted, the only liability we're dealing with here is for abandonment, correct?
That's what the letter agreement was intended to cover. I think repair replacement under the facts of this case is a red herring, because the structure was toppled into the ocean. It couldn't be repaired or it couldn't be replaced. That would be contemplated with ongoing operations. And it would be appropriate in that circumstance for the working interest owner to be liable. But here we've got abandonment that was necessitated by a platform that was toppled into the ocean. And under that circumstance, we looked at the letter agreement.
Well, it doesn't seem extraordinary to me that Judge Rosenthal, looking at this, and of course we have the issue of whether some of the expert testimony was relevant, but the division between the kinds of costs necessary that generally are not considered abandonment costs, but because of the storm would be other costs. But if you're headed towards abandonment, some of those costs in the industry, in the technical meaning of the term abandonment, would not be considered abandonment costs. Now, you have separate arguments as to why that wasn't admissible, but that's not an altogether illogical consideration, it seems to me, in trying to figure out what the unambiguous to industry people contract means and trying to explain it to judges.
I think, Judge Southwick, it is unreasonable given a couple things. It's unreasonable given the expansive definitions of abandonment expenses and abandonment operations in this agreement, in other words, the yellow language, which define without limitation, including without limit to, a variety of work associated with any aspect of getting the platform out of the water, removal and abandonment. It's also inconsistent, and I submit the broad expansive liability I'm arguing is consistent with the federal decommissioning regulations, 30 CFR 250.1703, which speak very broadly and very expansively of plugging the wells, removing the platform, which is exactly what happened here, decommissioning the pipelines, and cleaning up the stuff from the bottom of the ocean. It's also consistent, and this is very important, with this court's recent opinion cutting underwater, where the court held that the removal of a platform, in fact, a platform that had been toppled into the ocean by Hurricane Rita, just like this one, constitutes an operation associated with with abandoning a well. And there wasn't any discussion in that opinion that it mattered one whit that those expenses had gone up as a result of the platform being toppled into the ocean. The fact is, it encompassed removal. And removal is one aspect of abandonment, and it's covered. It was covered in cutting underwater, and it's covered in the letter agreement.
One question I had for you, and I guess for opposing counsel, too. This letter agreement has a paragraph in it that deals with breach by, well, it would be Mariner, by assigning the letter agreement to somebody that wasn't an approved assignee. And it says, any attempt by Forest to assign this letter agreement, except as provided in the circumstances described above, which is in the first sentence, says you got to get our, it says you can do it in a merger, shall cause this letter agreement to terminate and cause Forest to owe immediately and pay its share of the abandonment expenses as if Forest had surrendered the block to Devon and Phillips on the effective date pursuant to Section 22 of the Joint Operating Agreement. So you can rock along under this letter agreement for 10 years, and then you can have a breach by Mariner. You can have Mariner or Forest assign this thing in some way that's not permitted. And at that point, the date that governs for determining what amount of abandonment expenses have to be paid is the effective date. Now,
right.
You know, it's very odd that you could have a breach situation and you'd fix the liability of Forest, or in this case Mariner, as of the effective date, and yet you're saying here we're going to be responsible for all these hurricane expenses. I don't think that squares with that.
Well, I don't think we have
a breach. At least I think I wouldn't hang my hat on this, mm-hmm. but I would say that it supports Judge Rosenthal's result here.
Well, no one's ever raised that point, Judge King.
I know, but you know, this is, reminds me. I had a case not too long ago which resulted in a, I don't remember whether it was a published opinion or not, but there was one of these letter agreements. And, you know, it was 5 or 6 pages. And the parties were going at it hot and heavy. And there was a provision in this agreement that really absolutely made it clear that one of the parties' arguments simply wouldn't work. And so I asked about that and said, well, but nobody's said that. Well, but I'm a lawyer, you know. I mean, sure. I hope I am. That's my, it's always been my aspiration. So when I get asked to construe a letter agreement, I tend to read the whole thing. And the whole thing says that if 10 years down the road we have a breach here, unacceptable assignment, then your liability is as of the effective mm-hmm. date. Well, that supports, Mariners, and that supports, I wouldn't bet the ranch on it, but it supports Judge Rosenthal's result.
Well, I wouldn't bet the ranch on it either, Judge King, because there's no evidence that the assignment was any kind of a breach. I think.
Well, I'm not claiming that it was, but I'm saying you got to look for clues, you know, in this letter agreement about what the parties had in mind. And that is a clue.
Well, I think the more direct clues are in the definitions, the language I've highlighted in yellow, and then the very broad language that I've highlighted in blue, which talks about actual abandonment expenses. And we need to remember the context here, that under the JOA, Forest had to immediately pay the abandonment costs at the time of its withdrawal.
Let me ask about that, because what it actually also says, I mean, you're certainly right, that any party who wants to withdraw can assign its interest. And it seems to me it says if somebody's willing to accept that interest, they will stand in the shoes. And it's only if the assignment is not made that somebody who is withdrawing has to agree to pay abandonment costs. So it does seem to me that the, I won't say starting, but one approach is that they would step aside and have no further responsibility. But if they can't find somebody to assume their interest in that way, and this letter agreement was sort of the substitute for that, then the letter agreement certainly controls. But is that correct, that the general understanding under the original operating agreement is you could assign your interest and you would have no further responsibility for abandonment costs?
Well, no, because abandonment costs accrue at the outset, and when you withdraw, you're responsible for paying an estimated amount of the abandonment expenses, which is why they went out and got the Devon went out and got the Twachtman report to determine the estimate. That became a moot point when Forest Oil, the predecessor to Mariner, said, no, we want to defer our liability into the future. And the trade-off, of course, is when they decided to defer was that they became liable for all the actual abandonment expenses at the time they were incurred. I would also point out that it's been essentially stipulated by Mariner that they stand in the shoes of Forest Oil for purposes of this letter agreement. Everybody's agreed that Mariner is liable for the same thing Forest Oil would be liable for. And here, importantly, Forest Oil opted not to pay the estimate immediately upon the time of its withdrawal, but instead to defer it out into the future. And that's why they're liable for the risks associated with the increased costs that go along with changes in the platform and the wells and that sort of thing that may happen in the ensuing years. Mariner, in essence, is trying to have it both ways, saying we can defer, we can postpone, but we also get to limit. And that's not what the parties intended, and that's contrary to the language in the letter agreement.
But Mariner is not a working interest owner, is that right?
No, and neither was Forest, its predecessor, at the time it opted to withdraw.
So Mariner has no say in whether or not to abandon or to continue operating?
Correct.
That's a decision left to Devon.
Correct.
At least it excludes Mariner.
Yes, and that's why the JOA says that when a party withdraws, when it withdraws as a working interest owner, it has to accept the abandonment costs.
But if Devon had decided to continue operating,
right,
it would have borne all the costs that attended to the continuing operation.
That's right. That's exactly right. But when you're talking about abandonment, that's an obligation that accrued at the outset, and that stays with the withdrawing party. Here it's just a matter of timing and what amount they have to pay, a fixed estimate or a much higher expense, which they agreed to assume under the agreement. I don't have a lot of time here, but I do want to talk briefly about the, as outlined in the Twachtman report language. The court's holding, I think, turns on its reading of the green language. And if the court is wrong about that, its judgment cannot stand. I think we both agree with that. If the court is wrong, the judgment cannot stand. And, in fact, it is wrong. The court assumed that, as outlined in the Twachtman report, modifies the words abandonment expense. It does not. Under the correct rules of grammar, which we must consider, the words as outlined in the Twachtman report modify the wells, platforms, and
now,
equipment
on
the block.
Let me ask you something. Did you explain this grammar? I mean, did you get
sure
Judge Garner to come and speak
right
to Judge Rosenthal about this? I mean, that's
no, I didn't. But they are common sense principles of English grammar. This court has applied them time and time again in the Quinlan case and the Amy Unknown case. And it's a common sense principle that when you have adjectival prepositional phrases, in this case, as of the effective date, and as outlined in the Twachtman report, those are two adjectival prepositional phrases, they modify the nearest noun, in this case, wells, platforms, and equipment on the block. They do not modify the more remote words in the sentence. That's very common sense principle of grammar. I see my time is up. Can I just complete the sentence?
You can add a couple of sentences.
I will. And it comports, I think, with the purpose of the Twachman report, which was to help identify exactly which wells, platforms, and equipment on the block they'd be liable for, those as of the date and those as outlined in the Twachman report.
All right. Thank you. Let's see. Mr. DeLuca.
May it please the court, Brad DeLuca on behalf of the Mariner entities. At the district court, both Mariner and Devon asked Judge Rosenthal to interpret the letter agreement and all of its component parts in an effort to determine the intent of the parties based upon the plain meaning of the agreement. And it's the four component parts being, one, the letter agreement, secondly, being the assignment of record of title, which was incorporated into the letter agreement. Third was the Twachman report, as it has been referred to as, which was incorporated into the letter agreement. And finally, the joint operating agreement, or the JOA, in its attached COPUS provision. Judge Rosenthal used all of those components in coming to the determination of what she believed and what we believe was the correct intent of the parties relative to Mariner's responsibilities. These agreements and the totality of it was a side agreement that was entered into by the parties in an effort or as a result of Mariner's predecessor Forrest's desire to relinquish its interest in the block. And it was no insignificant decision. As Judge Rosenthal noted, the estimated costs were originally approximately $5 million. And as a result of the hurricane, those costs eventually exceeded $200 million.
At the time that Forrest was getting out of this field, is there any evidence as to what the anticipated continuing life of the field was, how likely it was that within just a couple years the abandonment costs would have to be paid, another 30 years?
I know of no reference or information in the record.
It seems to me it would be somewhat relevant as the reason I ask if, in trying to construe this agreement and what it meant to wait to pay the costs and what was expected to be those costs, whether it's thought that would happen fairly soon.
The closest thing in the record, I think, Your Honor, would be that Forrest had sold all of its Gulf assets to Mariner, and this was one of the assets that was sold. I don't know of anything in particular in the record that would say exactly how long the wells were going to produce in this particular block. Now, the Twachman report I would like to address first, and the significance of the Twachman report. Devon, in its reply brief, has made claims that we have made erroneous statements about the purpose of the Twachman report. And I think the best way to answer that question or those statements or respond is looking at the language of the Twachman report itself. The language of the Twachman report supports both Mariner and Judge Rosenthal's determination of what the plain meaning of the agreement meant. But more importantly, it specifically disproves the allegation that of Devon that somehow the Twachman report was a mere inventory. The meaning, extent, and scope is addressed in Section 1, entitled Summary of the Twachman Report, where it states as follows. TSB, an abbreviation for the Twachman Company, estimated Eugene Island 333 A and B platforms previously. For this report, TSB updated decommissioning methodology, resource rates, and also estimated the decommissioning costs for Eugene Island 312C. That's a record site at page 276. Now, why is this important? It tells the court that Devon had previously asked TSB to determine decommissioning methodology for Eugene Island 333A and B. It tells the court that Devon asked TSB to update the decommissioning methodology and resource rates for Eugene Island 333A and B. But most importantly, it proves that it was not a mere inventory. And it really begs the bigger question. Why would an energy company as large as Devon need a decommissioning entity, an estimator of decommissioning methodology and costs, to provide Devon an inventory of Devon's own assets?
No. What, as I understand it, I mean, I think this is in the record. I got it from the briefs. It must be in the record. That this report was, this update was actually ordered in order to provide an estimate of, to tell what the number would be if you're going to pay this today. This is the number. This is what you pay.
It was that and more, because it provided not only those estimates, but you would have to know what the work was being done, what that actual decommissioning work that was going to be done.
That's right. But
yes.
That's how you arrive at the number.
Actually, the two.
You know, we're going to do these 14 things, and then we get to the end of it. This is what it's going to cost if we do it all today.
Right, right. But it's important to note that their claim that it was a mere inventory is belied by your question.
Well, and it's belied by the purpose for which it was ordered.
Right, right. And so the fact that this information was no secret, that what the wells and the platforms were. Devon had it in its land department, would have had it in its operations department, because Devon was the operator of this block. All of this information would have been contained in Devon's own records. They would not have needed Twachman to provide them with their own inventory. It would be like me calling my insurance company, asking them to give me an inventory of the cars sitting in my driveway.
Okay.
They knew
so
what it was.
Judge Rosenthal, with your endorsement today, has used the report in a certain way and has interpreted the agreement to refer to it, despite some of the grammar rules that we're hearing about, in a certain way. Let me see. Regardless of whether we agree with some of her approach, does the Twachman report, using it as a status or nature of the work, what's the phrase that we're being used?
The decommissioning methodology, or it's also been referred to as a scope of work.
Scope of work. Does that differ to what the expert Taylor was saying when he was making this distinction between the cost to abandon versus the cost to place storm-damaged rigs, platforms in a position to be abandoned? If she was following, not consciously, but does that get you to the same place, this definition of what abandonment costs are?
The
because it does seem to me it's scope. I mean, it's the same issue of what needs to be done to abandon versus what needs to be done for some other purpose, and the agreement refers to abandonment, somewhat broader language than that, cost. So her decision was based on the Twachman report, correct?
Correct.
And how do, I mean, well, she's ordering reimbursements, as I recall, that too much was paid, and so Mariner's getting some money back was the final judgment.
Correct.
What was the total obligation by Mariner under her ruling?
What the court did is it took the total amount of, not in a pejorative sense, but the overpayment, the payments that Mariner had made. The Twachman report was then updated for the time period when, for those same, that same scope of work, it was updated for the time period when that scope of work was done.
Meaning current costs or
current
applicable
costs
at that time.
Right, and it was deducted from the overpayment.
So I'm just wondering, what was the total amount of responsibility in dollars that Mariner had?
It was approximately in excess at that point in time. It had risen up to about $900,000. The parties stipulated that they took the overpayment of about $5.3 million. They deducted that updated cost based upon the scope and what that would have been in an updated dollars, and it came to approximately $4.3 million. And that, along with the prejudgment interest, is what her final judgment was, that the amounts owing from Devon to Mariner.
Nobody here thought this ought to go to a jury. Everybody was glad for Judge Rosenthal to be the jury, right?
It was never in dispute, and at the very first status conference, that's what the parties agreed to in the briefing schedule.
Okay.
But it's also important to recognize about the Twachtman report that it was incorporated in by reference into the letter agreement without limitation. There's no limitation to what's in the what portions of the Twachtman report are going to be a part of the letter agreement. It was incorporated in by reference in its entirety. And also, with regards to their assertion as to the Twachtman report, that somehow it was solely for Devon's own use, is belied by the fact that it became a part of the agreement of the parties once it was attached. So,
let me ask, on the costs updated on the Twachtman report, was a lot of that fictitious at that time because of the storm? The $5 million or so of expenses really weren't paid in that way? Things set out in the scope of work weren't done because of the storm? I mean, were the real numbers, real payments represented there, or was it just sort of a generic updating of what would have been paid, current dollars, applicable date dollars, if there had been no storm?
The parties agreed simply to take the Twachtman report and the scope of work and ask the same company, Twachtman, has changed its name now, it's called ProServe, to update those to the time of approximately 2007, I believe. And they updated it based upon that, in large part because Devon's corporate representative in his deposition, Tim Enderlin, on behalf of Devon, admitted that all $200 million was as a result of storm damage. So we took the assumptions based in the set forth in the Twachtman report, the scope of work. Twachtman updated it to, at the time that the work was done, and got to the approximately $900,000 figure.
You know, I know I'm not supposed to talk apparently about other provisions in the contract, but you know, if Mariner had assigned this thing to somebody else, unapproved, they would have gotten off here for what they actually got off for, probably.
Right.
They would have taken the Twachtman report, updated it to deal with inflation, and that would have been it.
We would have come to the same
free and clear.
Right. I agree. And the final thing I'd like to say about the Twachtman report is that the problem with Devon's assertion that it is a mere inventory would render the majority of it superfluous. And the case law, I don't have to repeat to the court, that when the court is interpreting a contract that is unambiguous, needs to give effect to the entire report so as to not render any portion of it superfluous, meaningless.
But in that report, getting back to what Judge King pointed out about it, if you prepare a report for one purpose and that purpose isn't fulfilled and you would make it an exhibit for a different purpose, it does seem to me a bit of a stretch to apply that doctrine. I mean, the report wasn't just for this final agreement. It was for a different approach. And when it was decided that those payments would be delayed, all that language was still there. And whether you decide how much of it's still relevant or not, it does seem to me that the doctrine you're talking about, no surplus language, may not apply.
Agreed, but if there were limitations on the scope, it could have been addressed by Devon and was not. I'd like to quickly talk also about the assignment of record title and the COPUS provision. As of the effective date, which is December of 2000, Mariner's predecessor, Forrest, was no longer a working interest owner anymore in this entire block, and was no longer a part of the joint account.
That's right. And therefore, if there had been a storm, would not have been responsible for the storm costs, damage repairs.
And at that point in time, when Forrest, Mariner's predecessor, assigned all right, title, and interest, all the way back to that point, that date, as of December 1st, 2000, it no longer owned any of the property. It was not a member of the joint account. It owned no working interest. At that point in time, all of that was the responsibility at that time of Devon and Phillips, both of those parties, and then subsequently at the time that this hurricane hit, Devon had acquired Phillips' interest, and so at that point in time, it would solely be just Devon. And so the Eastern District of Louisiana has recently, in the Nippon case that we cited in our brief, has addressed this exact issue. The COPUS provisions were identical. In the Nippon case, the assignors, which would be Mariner's predecessor Forrest, and in Nippon Murphy, both assigned all right, title, and interest. And following Hurricane Rita, a storm struck, and there was a dispute over who owed money as a result of the storm damage. And the Nippon court ruled exactly the same way that Judge Rosenthal ruled on the issue of the applicability of the assignment as of the effective date, as well as the language of the joint operating agreement and the COPUS provision, where the court said that Murphy did not agree to embrace any obligations that were caused by hurricanes which occurred after the assignment. They said that Murphy was not a working interest owner under the joint operating agreement on the dates the storm struck, and was not liable for increases in decommissioning costs caused by storm damage that occurred after the effective date of the assignment. This is exactly the same decision that Judge Rosenthal came to, in her opinion, utilizing the COPUS provision and the assignment effective as of December 1st of 2000. Basically, Judge Rosenthal got it right. She took the letter agreement, the Twachtman report, the assignment of record of title, the operating agreement, and the attached COPUS provision to determine what the plain meaning of the agreement was and what the intent of the parties were at all times, with the stipulation that the agreement was not ambiguous. And she reached the result that, based on the fact that it included and as outlined in the Twachtman report, meant that that was another portion of the agreement between the parties which comport with Mariner's interpretation of the letter agreement. Devon has taken and attempted to take a few words, a phrase, a sentence, or a couple of sentences out of just the letter agreement in an attempt to reach a ruling based upon some grammatical terms of art that are not applicable in this case, because the agreement was not ambiguous and because of the plain meaning of the agreement and the interpretation reached by the judge. We would respectfully ask the court to affirm Judge Rosenthal's decision.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Neill.
Good morning.
Morning.
And may it please the court, I'm Jack O'Neill, and I am here for Devon. Let me briefly, if I might, just explain the history of what happened here. There came a point in time, there were three interest owners in this block. There was Phillips, there was Devon, there was Forrest. Forrest is Mariner's predecessor. There came a time when Forrest wanted to withdraw. And this will go to something Judge Graves asked about, whether or not at the time this hurricane occurred, Forrest was a working interest owner. Forrest wanted to withdraw. The other two parties consented to Forrest's withdrawal. Forrest did withdraw, but they assumed the obligations in the letter agreement as a quid pro quo for their withdrawal. That left the working interest in the hands of Devon and in the hands of Phillips, and of course Devon later succeeded to 100% of the ownership. Later, Mariner or Forrest had other assets in the Gulf of Mexico and wanted to sell them, and it decided to sell them, but it had this liability trailing along with those assets, and it sold all of its other assets to Mariner, and this liability, which was a residual liability resulting from the block EI 333, followed along with it. I want to, if I can, very quickly talk about something Judge Southwick mentioned when he talked about this distinction between abandonment expenses and storm damage expenses. Your Honor, that is something that Judge Rosenthal, there was an affidavit that was submitted by an expert in this case, Steve Taylor, and that was submitted by Mariner. And what Steve Taylor did was he said, well, there's a difference between routine abandonment expenses on the one hand and storm damage expenses on the other hand. and Mariner is liable only for routine abandonment expenses, not storm damage expenses. And I would respectfully suggest that that flies right in the face of this court's opinion in the Cutting Underwater case. And it's really the Cutting Underwater case, not the case that Mr. DeLuca referred to, which I'll get to in just a minute, which is on all fours with this case. In the Cutting Underwater case, it was a Fifth Circuit case, and the issue in this case is, was the removal of an offshore platform damaged and toppled and dismantled by Hurricane Rita abandonment work? And as a matter of fact, this platform that was damaged and dismantled was on the block right next door. And this court answered, yes, that constitutes abandonment work. The removal of a platform damaged, toppled, and dismantled by Hurricane Rita is an abandonment operation. It's part and parcel of the process of abandonment. And this court went on to hold that despite Hurricane Rita, despite the damaged and toppled and dismantled condition of the platform, and despite the increased cost of the removal of the platform because of this, the removal was a typical well site activity that was part and parcel of abandonment expenses. So you have that case, which is the holding of this circuit on the one hand, and then you have the district court's adherence to this distinction drawn by this expert that Mariner offered about, well, no, wait a minute, there's this distinction between storm damage expenses on the one hand and routine abandonment expenses on the other hand. Well, there is no such distinction.
Well,
the letter agreement doesn't refer to such a
there is distinction. In the sense that if the decision had been made to go on and keep going with this thing, all these storm damage expenses would have been borne by the working interest owners.
That is correct, and that's the way it should.
There is a distinction in the industry as to what happens to storm damage.
Absolutely, and that's the way it should be. Judge Southwick was discussing with Mr. Levenger paragraph 7 of the COPUS, and under paragraph 7 of the COPUS, it doesn't say that working interest owners are responsible. What it says is the working interest owners are responsible for repair and replacement costs brought about by storm damage, and that's the way it should be, because
that's
if you're
what Mr.
working
Taylor's affidavit addressed, isn't it? You'd be more familiar. He was suggesting that you treat these extra costs as the equivalent of repair costs, I thought. You don't have much time, but I thought that was, I'll look to see if that was addressed.
Well, I don't think that is exactly correct, Your Honor. I think that, well, I see my time is up before I made the one point I wanted to make, which is the reefing jacket issue point, which I think illustrates exactly why the district court's opinion is incorrect. But I see that my time is up.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take that on the brief.